We are going on a road trip.
Who's with me?
Can you dig it?
We are on a mission from God.
Can you dig it?
Can you dig it?
Let's go.
Hey, I'm Brian Duffy.
And I'm Russell Davis.
And this is Road Rash. What is Road Rash? Road Rash is Russell Davis and Brian Duffy traveling around the world, something we've done for the last couple of years, so much so that people are dying to know what some of our experiences are. Two guys who literally live life to the fullest. You can't beat this. You can't get past this.
Guys, come out, eat, drink, travel with us. Every episode, including this week, we're going to have special guests.
Every Tuesday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard.
From a different location around the world.
Don't be a rash hole. Get your devices ready.
Come on out, all you rash holes. Every Tuesday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard.
Hey, I'm Brian Duffy.
And I'm Russell Davis.
We're going to eat,
drink,
and travel. This is Road Rash.
Okay, boys and girls, welcome to the second episode of the Road Rash podcast. Chef Brian Duffy and myself are here.
Hello.
And as per our bet, or not a bet last week, but our actual vote, I'm sitting here naked recording this for you guys. So there's a little visual image for you that you'll see in the comic book.
I've got assless chaps on. Just because I felt the need that nobody actually wanted to see my entire naked body, I'm just showing ass.
All chaps are assless.
Damn it, you are. You're from Texas. You know these things. I love my chaps, dude. I wear chaps when I ride.
Oh, dude. There's like nothing makes you feel cooler than putting on chaps and riding your motorcycle. Seriously.
I totally agree with you. And you know what? They actually saved my skin once. I had my own little version of road rash, where I got some guy opened his car door as I was passing him, and I hit the brakes and I hit gravel and I skid, and hopefully my mother's not listening to this. So
yeah, because I've had those moments. That's scary fucking shit when that stuff happens to you, especially on a motorcycle. Life flash before you.
Yeah, ask. Big time. And the cool part is I was riding with like 10 other guys, and the coolest part was all these guys had ridden together before, and I was with one other guy that I've who I've known, but I never rode with. And when it happened, I was on my side. I was on my ass bone, my chaps, and my elbow. And oddly enough, that was what I hurt, was those little areas. But I ended up breaking my foot, but we'll get into that. And what happened was, as I got up, like I stood up after the whole thing happened, I was like in shock. And this kid, who was probably 19 or 20 years old, came over and stood in front of me. And he looked me up and down, like with this crazy panic look on his eyes. And he stared at me for a second. And then he just started grabbing me. Like, he grabbed my head and he started like rubbing it. And he grabbed my neck and my shoulders and my arms. He's like, "Are you okay? Does any of this hurt?" And he literally like patted me down to see if I had broken anything. It was pretty wild, man. But the guys behind us, as I fell, they went into a wedge. I don't know if you've ever heard of this before, but if you're riding in a pack and somebody goes down, you ride in a wedge. So that way no cars can get into that lane. So there you go.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I had my own. It was. Dude, I rode the bike home. The bike was stuck in third gear. So I finally got the bike home.
You rode the bike home with a broken foot?
Yeah, but my mother might be listening, so let's not discuss that. I did. I rode the bike home with a broken foot. And it was stuck in third gear. And then I got home and I changed my shoe. I didn't know my foot was broken at that point, but then I changed my boots and I went back to the bar. I met everybody at the bar after, cause it was like a nice ride and we were all going to meet at the bar after. Well, I didn't want them to think I was dead. So I went back to the bar and I had a couple of beers. I didn't have beers beforehand. I want everybody to know I am a huge person to say that I do not drink and ride. Like, I don't even have a beer. Like, I'm not that guy. I'm not that guy. Yep. Too many jackasses out there. So, Russell, I interrupted you. We were discussing assless chaps.
Yeah, I don't know. That was a pretty awesome fucking story, though. It's like one of those, whenever you have one of those falls and the people around you go, "Oh, man, you just handled that fall well."
That's exactly what they said. That was the guy was like, "You literally landed exactly the way that you were supposed to." And he said, "You rolled with it. You skewed like," he's like, "You surfed the gravel." And I was like, "Yeah, I did exactly. I learned that in my motorcycle class."
now I'm gonna go park the bike and get drunk and think about my life.
No, I only had one beer because I'm other than when I'm on the road, I'm not a big drinker at home, except for this past New Year's Day. But we'll discuss that in the later. I guess I do drink a lot. Oh my God. Okay, can you please talk about something else?
You bet, man. You bet. So, not our drinking habits.
Yeah, exactly.
There's doctors that are like, how many drinks do you have a week? And you're just like, doctor, you really don't know that.
On the road or off is usually the question that I say.
Yeah. I'm off the road. I'm like, no drinks.
Yeah, none. I'm good.
Yeah. But when you're on the road, it's just like part of the business, you know?
It is. I mean, because you know what? There's because you're back in that camaraderie because of the fact of what we do now. When we're not behind the bar, we're not in the kitchen as much. I mean, I still run kitchens, I oversee kitchens, I still cook, I do all that stuff. But I'm not behind the line anymore. And there's something to be said for that end of shift, that drink, that couple of drinks.
Oh man, especially if it's in everything's closed down and it's in the middle of the night, you know, and you're sitting there with maybe the one other guy or girl that you had just like bartended or cooked with that night in a busy night. Oh man, having that beer out of your tin, drinking your beer, that draft beer out of your bar tin.
Yeah. We used to always give the kitchen guys roadies. They're not roadies. We always used to give them the shift drink. That was like the way. It's like a thank you. It's like a huge thank you for everything you did. Because look, I mean, we're going to talk about this in a second. We're going to talk about the wages and what bartenders and waiters and cooks make. You know, these guys are making 10, 11 bucks an hour. You know, and they're watching. And one of my rules in my kitchens for my waitresses and any waitress who's out there who's ever worked for me, whether you hated me or whether you loved me, you know that I had one rule, and that was that you never, ever, ever counted money in front of the cooks. You never came in the kitchen with your till from the end of the night where you're laying out all your 20s and your 50s and your hundos and your ones and your fives and all that. You're laying them out and you're counting out your drawer or you're counting out anything in front of guys who just busted their ass behind the line for 11 bucks an hour. And you got a dishwasher over there who's making $9. Like, come on. You're not going to do that in front of them.
Yeah.
So just give them a damn beer. Fucking beer. I want to have a Budweiser, please.
You get a Miller Lite and a shot of Rebel Mints.
You know what I know, Russell? Do you know what I know by heart? This is the famous Budweiser beer we know of no other brand produced by another brewer, which costs so much to brew and aids our exclusive beats with aging, produces the smoothest taste and drinkability you will find in no other beer at any price. How about that? Do you know what that is? That's that little fucking writing right on the label, right on that cute little label on the top of the Budweiser bottle. And I don't have a Budweiser in front of me. I just loved Budweiser.
Okay, one more time. Go for it. Do it.
This is the famous Budweiser beer we know of no other brand produced by another brewer, which costs so much to brew and aids our exclusive beats with aging, produces the smoothest taste and drinkability you will find in no other beer at any price.
Boom.
Yeah, I can do this. End of the world as we know it as well, but not that well. It's been a long time, but I definitely know the Budweiser bottle. And I'll tell you a really funny story about Cuba sometime, but not right now. So go ahead.
That's pretty damn amazing,
dude. It's one of the things. I mean, I can't remember where my keys are, but I know that. I totally do. Have you heard of Tile, Russell?
Tile.
Tile. It's a little tracking device. Uh-huh. And I'll take a picture of it and I'll tweet it a little bit later. But Tile is a little tracking device that works through Bluetooth. I have a Tile in my wallet. I have a Tile in my suitcase. I have a Tile in my knife case. I have a Tile in my glove box in my car. Uh-huh. I have a Tile on my keys. And then if I lose anything, I go to my app on my phone and I just hit the thing and it says find and it starts beeping and it tells me where it is. It's a Bluetooth locator. Yeah. It's awesome.
Holy crap.
Yeah, dude, it's the greatest thing. Like, if I can't find my suitcase, I was at the airport and I lost my suitcase and I hit the Tile app and I was like, dude, my suitcase is in the fucking office behind you. Like, they couldn't find it. It was in the office behind the girl. So, yeah, I went on a rampage again. Rant.
Wow.
Yeah, it's fun.
Wow. That's revolutionary for the travelers and the drinkers out there, too, you know?
Yeah, you're breaking up a little bit, Russell. You're breaking up.
Sorry about that. How's this now?
That's much better. Perfect.
Cool. Yeah, that's revolutionary for the travelers and the drinkers out there. Shit. Why have I not heard of that
exactly
yet?
Exactly. Cool. And now they're coming out all over the place.
On it. Yeah. Ordering it now. Kyle, I'm coming.
Yeah.
Be your big customer.
Yeah.
So I guess we should move into the questions, you know? I mean, we're trying to keep this one, I guess, a little under 4.5 hours.
Yeah.
The last one. Thank all you rashholes out there for the support, because you guys have been showing us some love on social media. Yeah, iTunes, you know. You guys, we just appreciate the support, and thanks for everything. So, you know, if you have any questions for us, just hashtag rashhole questions and we'll get it to you. And if you have any just things you want to comment on or what we're saying or have a response, you know, you should hashtag rashhole response and tell us what you think about some of the stuff we're saying. Yeah. I'd love to hear what you think, guys.
Me too.
That being said, this is not a Q&A session, but this next topic was actually sparked by a rational question that popped up on Twitter from Serving the Industry, which is at the Bar Industry, is the Twitter handle.
Hey, Russ, but she basically, I hate to tell you this, but you're breaking up.
Yeah.
You're breaking up. See, hey, just so everybody knows, this is not like we don't like for some people, this is a total science. But for me and Russell, it's not, because we're totally in like different locations. So if sometimes if you guys hear us, we may stop each other and just say, because we're not going to edit this stuff out. Like, we want to keep going forward. We don't want to have all these crazy little edits here and there. We want you guys to hear exactly what it is that we talk about. And this is the stuff that we talk about. Russell starts talking and I interrupt him. And usually it's with a story, but sometimes it's for me to tell him that he's breaking up. So there you go.
Perfect.
You're totally breaking up.
How's that now, though? Am I doing good now?
Cool. You're okay.
Okay, great. So this next topic is from the bar industry, a Twitter handle. She'd asked a rational question, but basically the thoughts on the $2.13 an hour tip minimum wage. Because the federal tip minimum wage hasn't changed in 20 years. She's actually referring to the $2.13 an hour that's in Texas, but actually exists in many other parts of the country. But to me, there's a larger topic to talk about here, and it's even the restaurants that are beginning to take on the non-tipping policies, which basically means that they're raising the prices of the food and beverages just a little bit. You're pretty much paying the same amount if you were tipping 15 or 20%, and they're raising the wages of the actual employees so that you don't have to tip as a customer. And then you have like really high profile places doing this, like Per Se in New York, Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California, Bar Marco in Pittsburgh. So it's a really big, huge topic, and I know that we have some opinions about that, right, Duffy?
Oh, I have an opinion about everything, but I totally have an opinion about that. But I'm going to let you go first, because in your end of it, I mean, my end is back of house, of course, but I with my business and my clients, I deal a lot with front of house as well. So I hear this topic all the time. But on your angle, I really want to know, because of the fact that, one, your clients deal with the same thing, but you were a full-fledged, really a tipped employee. I mean, your salary... Yeah. You may have been making $2.13 an hour or $2.83 an hour or $3.12 an hour, you know, in some of these other states. But in reality, your salary came down to what you made in tips that night.
Absolutely. And I was one of those bartenders that I was not a 20% bartender. I was a 30 or 40% bartender with my tips. So if you brought down and averaged that out for a bartender like me in the industry, I wouldn't have made as much throughout my life, my career doing this. And probably would have changed careers at some point, because I didn't have the ability to make my own money. Because they're literally making these tipping policies so that you can't tip. You know, the employee can't actually accept that money from you. And to me, that's just absolutely, I very much love the culture of what certain regions are. And that's part of American culture. And I don't like changing that. My knee-jerk reaction is to not change that. And not take away that ability to make more money. Now, I can understand why, it kind of averages out with other people, and it actually puts the kitchen versus the front of the house on kind of a better playing field as well, a more relatable playing field, so one's not making just a shit ton more money than the other. But for the love of God, give the bartenders, the front of house, give whoever can the opportunity to take that money. You know, if anything, spread the tip more, love more to the kitchen as well. But don't take it away from anybody. But I think that it's just not taking from some of the articles that I've read. You know, customers are literally like forcing the money into these waiters, waitresses, and bartenders' hands that there's no way to really fight it. But, you know, there's a lot of different articles saying different things on that. So that's I have a feeling you and I have the same opinion. So I'm going to kind of play devil's advocate on whatever you say, Duffy.
Well, okay, so first off, just so we get this right, the question came from a girl named Serving the Industry. I say it's a girl because there's a woman in the picture. I don't know. I'm just going with what I see. And there, her handle is at the bar industry. Okay, so that's who she is. So thank you very much for that question. Russell and I have gone back and forth on this a little bit, not in a debate, but in a conversation. For me, I believe in tipping. I'm a huge fan of tipping, and I believe that if you're going to be in the service industry, then a tip is a major part of the job that you do. And so when I was checking out of my hotel on Saturday morning and the guy brought my car around, I tipped him. He went down, got the car, he brought it back up for me, and he gave it to me, and I tipped him $5, and it was a $50, it was at a hotel, so it was a $50 valet charge from the night before. So I tipped him 10%, okay? Now, do I normally tip more than that? If somebody's waiting on me where they're giving me drinks, if they're giving me food, I do tip 20%, I tip 25%. There's times where I walk out knowing it's going to be a huge night, and I may just drop a $100 bill in the girl's hand or something more than that or whatever it is, just to say thank you. Like, I love to tip because that's the industry that we're in. So
Absolutely. And I love being remembered as that guy, because sometimes when you get that excellent service and you get that huge tip, you know, it literally can be life-changing for these people sometimes. Sure. You know, I remember walking into I was working at Carlos and Charlie's in Austin, Texas, and I literally had this awful month. The lake had dry. Everything had worked against this summer season at this bar that was just legendary for so many years I had worked at previous seasons. But and I just gotten done on basically a nationwide nine-month Harley trip and spent all my money, and so I was my well run dry, and I was walking into one of those trips where I had cut that hot check for my rent, and
you're wondering how you're gonna pay for the black jeans that you now have to buy to go to work.
Yeah. Oh, you know? Yeah. Or the shoes that are going out. Yeah. Because you're going into so much. Yeah.
Yeah.
And.
Russ, hold on for one second. Just back up for a second. You broke up really bad there, so we lost you. So you said we discussed the jeans, black jeans, couldn't afford them. You just came in off this crazy Harley trip. Go.
So I needed money. I just needed it. And it was one of those that wrote their hot check for rent. And I had to make that decision that if I didn't make the money, I had to figure out how to make the money. You know, it was one of those like survival, you know, and it's one of the worst decisions I was even wrestling with myself to this day morally, that I would say to make the decision that, you know, out of my career that day I would steal if I had to in order to survive. And I didn't want to, and I wrestled with that. But, you know, I had to make that decision, and I still hate that. But luckily, you know, I walked into shift that day, and I just had this group of guys that were just drunk as hell, but just being assholes. And apparently they just bought this big old boat, and I just kept on giving them the perfect service, because I wasn't trying to steal. I was trying to make as much on tips that day as possible. And these guys were just big assholes, and I just kept on smiling, kept on being perfect with them. And at the end of the closeout, the guy looks at me and he goes, "How much of a tip do you want?" I immediately looked at him and I said, $1,000. $1,000 on the tip line, signed it, and I was just floored by it. That was like life-changing moment to me. And so to me, you know, tipping is something I'll always, always, always support. You know?
Well, and I think, you know, I was in New York a couple of weeks ago. I was in Philly this weekend. I was in, you know, I mean, I was in like a drunken city this weekend. I mean, Philly was New Year's Day, one of the biggest days of the year, the whole nine yards. And I mean, I tip, you know, I order two beers or whatever it was in one bar, and, you know, whatever it was, $10, and I give the guy a 20. It's New Year's Day. You're busting your ass. So, you know, keep the change. And the guy doesn't even acknowledge the fact that I just gave him a 100% tip. Not that I'm looking for the acknowledgement. Please don't think that I'm only tipping because I want to get recognized for that or any of that stuff. But I tip because of good service. If you're busting your ass, then guess what? I'm going to throw you a couple extra bones. It's the way that it works. You know, if I walk up to a bar and I get a beer and it's $5 and you hand me back, you know, five ones, I'm going to leave two with you. So my beer cost me $7. I don't have a problem with that. You know what I mean? I'm going to do that.
And don't say number wise because I'm not trying to brag, but percentage wise, what do you think is the biggest tip you've left?
I mean, I'll do a number. I mean, I can do an easy number. I mean, I remember walking into a club in Vegas with our buddy Shane and we and a couple other really good friends of mine. You haven't met these guys yet, but you're going to meet them this year in Vegas. You're going to meet Rick and Rich who are Rich. Well, we'll get into that, but these are really good buddies of mine. And I remember going into the night knowing that this was going to be an epic evening. There was no doubt in my mind it was going to be an epic night. And I walked over to our bartender's name was Valerie. Not even our bartender, because we were in VIP. So, and one of our friends was with us. JT was with us that night, and I remember walking over to her about 11 o'clock or 11:30 at night, and I handed her $500, and I said, "It's going to be one of those nights." And she just looked at me and kind of laughed. And that was it. And I knew that. And again, like this was for. What's that?
She knew what it meant.
I didn't hear you.
She knew what it meant.
Oh, she knew exactly what it meant. Yeah. And she knew. And every time I turned around, I needed a drink. She was right there. And she went from originally calling me chef to Duff Balls. Because Duff Balls is one of my nicknames. All my close buddies, my guys that live around me, they call me Duff Balls. Okay?
Really?
Yeah, they do. Dude, my nickname is – I have a couple of nicknames. One is Duff Balls, and I've got a rugby nickname that I'm not going to get into. That's strictly for my rugby buddies. And then I've got Duff. Everybody calls me Duff or B-Duff. So, but my buddies, my really close buddies that live at home, where I live in Philly, they call me Duff Balls. So now I have a pretty weird feeling everybody's going to start calling me Duff Balls. I'm okay with that. I'm all right with that.
Hashtag Duff Balls, everyone.
As long as you don't hashtag Duff's Balls, we're good. You can hashtag Duff Balls all you want. But
totally fine.
I dropped $500 on that night. And because of the fact that she was – I knew that she was going to be good because we're in a VIP and they always put the greatest ones in the VIP, not just the really hot ones. She was super hot, but she was really good at what she did. Every time that she turned around, she's like, "Hey, chef, do you need a drink? Duff Balls, do you need a drink?" as the night progressed. And then the bill came. So the bill was a little bit more than I originally anticipated. And I'm not going to tell the number online out here, but it was a big, 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 big bill.
I love the way you put that. A little more than originally anticipated.
Because, you know, I mean, yeah, it was a little bit more than I originally anticipated. It was a big
worst
night.
Feeling in the world.
And the scariest feeling, too. When that little black tray comes around, and there's like five numbers on there.
Oh, man.
It's not.
And then being like being the person on the other side that's delivering that black tray with the five numbers, you're always wondering, like, how they're going to take it.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Okay. And who are they going to hand it to? Because at that point, I was just a short, fat, drunk dude hanging out in Vegas. I wasn't a roller. You know, I didn't have, like bitches hanging on my shoulders. I didn't have, I wasn't a rapper. Like, I just was a dude who was boozing, and I was with a bunch of guys. So long story, the bill got taken care of, and everything was good. But that was probably the biggest tip that I've ever left. And she deserved every single one of those $500. So
nice.
She deserved it.
Nice.
But to go back to the initial, so my idea with that is I believe in paying for service. I believe that if you do a great job, then you should get that tip. And I've been in the industry long enough, and I've listened to waitresses come back. Can you believe that guy only left me $10 on a $100 bill? And I used to say, like, well, what'd you do? What did you do? Did you deserve $10 or did you deserve $25? Because if you deserve – go ahead.
Yeah, or what did you not do?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, and there's times, hey, look, I understand about the kitchen and I understand all that stuff and things happen in the kitchen. And but to blame it on the kitchen all the time, I'm not a huge fan of. I'm a huge believer in front and back of house, working cohesively. We all have to. I hate the animosity that happens. And this is going to be a part of my topic that we're going to talk about in a couple minutes. But to finish my point with this, what I'm saying is if you're in the service industry, you should be tipped accordingly. So now, with that being said, if I just have 10 waitresses that are making 15 bucks an hour, why are they going to work harder to serve me if they're only making the same, if they're all making the same amount? Why are they going to work? Why are they going to go above and beyond to take care of me if they're getting the same amount no matter what? And on top of that, what is going to happen to the seasoned professionals, the seasoned bartenders, the what I call the Marcellos? And the reason why I say Marcellos is because one of the greatest waiters in Philadelphia was known as Marcello. And he was this great guy. He worked at the Palm. Now he works at Fleming Steakhouse near me. And he's an amazing waiter. And he's one of those guys that you walk in, you see him, he recognizes you, even if you're not sitting in his section. He comes over to my table all the time. Chef, it's great to see you. How are you? Can I get you a drink? Can I do this? Can I do that? He's not even my waiter, but he works off of tips. So what's going to happen when Marcello, the seasoned professional career waiter, is now working next to the same girl who just took the money from me at the dry cleaners? Or the same guy who just pumped my gas. Or the same person who, and there's nothing wrong with those careers or those fields at all, but they're not service industry. They're not service related in certain ways. They don't have that same, they're not working as hard to make more money because they're not getting tipped, because they're not getting tipped. Marcello's working ass off because he's getting tipped.
And also, you know, Marcello being a seasoned veteran, all the Marcellos of the world being seasoned veterans, they've literally set their career, they're the way they budget their lives and their career because of the way that this is done. So whenever you change this, you're literally shaking up the way that these seasoned veterans have earned their living, paid their bills for their entire lives and careers.
Absolutely. And you nailed it on the head, because what they do is they budget. They know that their big time, their crazy time, their insane time, their money time is happening during this period right now, which is that first week of Thanksgiving going all the way through to New Year's, because they know that, guess what? Nobody's going out January 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th. Because they just blew all their money going out for the Christmas. They spent the money. You know, think about the beginning of the school year. How busy are bars and restaurants in the beginning of the school year? Because the parents are all at home. They're getting the kids back into school. They're trying to find that routine. And you're not making $700 a week in tips. Now you're making $450 a week in tips. So, you know, I got a problem with it. I'm not a fan of it. I don't know why we're trying to do it. You know, it works in Europe, but guess what? It's not going to work for me.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, that's the thing. It's American culture. So let's not, you know, I hate to be the, you know, I don't want to get into a quicksand of always making mistakes, cultural mistakes, because it's cultural. But, you know, this is really part of the service industry of America, the United States. So
yes,
let's not change that.
And not only that, but I in my business talk about all the time that we have 100% of employees, okay? And within that 100%, we have 20% that work up on the top. The 20% are the people that bust their ass to get the job done. Russell's a 20%er. Russell's the guy who comes into work 5 minutes early. He sets his station up. He might help his buddy set the station up. He's the guy who's not yelling at a barback to go get ice, because guess what? The barback's not there just yet. Maybe he just walked in. Russell's going to go grab some ice and throw it behind the bar. Okay, he's going to cut extra lemons, because it's not just his lemons he's cutting. He's cutting lemons for the bar. He's cutting lemons for the servers, because you know what? Russell cuts them faster than everybody else. Russell's also the guy who kind of walks around and gets everybody pumped up before the shift. Russell's the guy who shakes the hand when they come into the bar. Russell's the guy who has the conversation. And who are they remembering when they leave? When they leave Davis's Mixology Bar, they're going, Russell was an awesome guy, and he was the dude that I want to go back to. Then next to Russell, we have the 60% of people, and the 60% of people are the Melissas and the Jonies and the Toms. And what they're doing is they're just coming into work.
They're doing their job. They like it. They enjoy it. They love working with Russell because Russell sets them up for success. They do a nice job. They ring good sales, but they're not the above and beyond. And then we have the bottom 20% of employees. The bottom percent are what I call the cancers of the business. Man, I can't believe I have to work a Tuesday again. Tuesdays suck around here. The manager sucks who's working tonight. He never knows what he's doing. They don't do anything to promote this place. So I believe that the 20%, we should always be revolving doors on our 20%. Get rid of them. Make the 60% move up into the 20. Hopefully, ultimately, we'll end from 20 to 40. I know I'm talking a lot of numbers, but what I'm saying is that without tipping, what is the point of working harder other than exactly. just to keep your job? It's not to make more money now. So
I totally agree.
If this mic didn't cost so much damn money, Russell, I would literally drop it on the floor right now. But the company paid for it, so I can't do that.
Just fling your computer through the fucking
just
window.
Throw the MacBook Air through the computer. Yep. Dude, these Blue Yeti microphones are awesome. I love them.
Yeah, I'm actually, I had to track down a cheap microphone because my other microphone got lost.
Where'd you lose that, so Russell?
Just underneath some bed somewhere.
Checking. I didn't know you were actually going to answer that question, but that was Russell lost his microphone at one point. And I'm like, dude, how do you lose like a 9-pound microphone? How does that just get lost? He's like, dude, it must have just rolled out of my bag somewhere.
those blue microphones, the brand was Blue. And so it's literally like a fucking softball that weighs about 5 pounds. And I think it just like rolled. So someone's like come across like a silver ball that looks like space age and they don't know what it is underneath their bed somewhere.
Exactly. And she's going, I got to clean this shit up. They didn't even leave me a tip. So it's called, just so you know, Russell, that's called the snowball.
The snowball.
It's called the snowball. Yeah. The snowball. Oh. So that's what it's called. Okay. So should we be professional and like wrap up our thoughts on the tipping?
I don't know. I think everybody knows it.
Yeah, they don't give a shit.
We literally like repeat the same conversation. Like, can we just get ourselves like amped up about it again?
I know.
I mean, unless you can wrap it up. I think you could wrap it up better than I could.
So to wrap it up, I think that we both agree that to go with a non-tipping restaurant is not a wise decision for the service industry. I don't believe in it. I'm not a fan of it. I think that people work harder when they know that they're going to be getting paid to do a job rather than just getting paid. If they're getting tipped out, they're going to work harder for that money. That's why we're in the service industry. We serve you. We receive a tip for that, which in turn pays our bills. And that's how I feel.
Yeah. Allow the service industry workers to be entrepreneurs.
Yeah, absolutely. Otherwise, we're just going to have the Marcellos. And we're going to have, you know, the Bob the Enforcers. Bob the Enforcers. I want to see Maggie. So just so everybody knows, we had a creative call today. Russell and Relax Just Create, which is a part of which is a guy named Rob and a guy named Dwayne and Eric. Eric is our audio editor. And we had our web designer, who is Michelle from Techno Solutions, and we had Maggie Gagliardi. And Maggie Gagliardi is this super cool chick who's the illustrator. And we both feel bad for her because we keep throwing characters into this, like Bob the Enforcer. And so, Maggie, I want to know what Bob the Enforcer is going to look like, because he's going to rear his ugly head a couple of times on these episodes. So I'm just letting you know.
Oh, man, it's got to be in Bob the Enforcer toy, you know?
Oh my God! Do we really have to get involved in design now? Oh shit!
Bob the Enforcer action figure.
Russell, we're just trying to figure out how to record without telling you to stop for a second because we can't understand you, and now you want to go into toy distribution. Come on, dude!
Enforcer bobble figure, man. I'm thinking about it.
But I see Enforcer Bob as having like massive forearms, and like a tiny little head, and like a black leather jacket.
Boom.
Yeah. That's Bob the Enforcer, dude. And black jeans.
All black.
All black. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he's
and like,
white.
If he had the jacket off, he had like a really tight black t-shirt. Might even say Bob the Enforcer on it.
But he's got a gut. He's got like a beer belly.
Yeah, yeah. Because he's a veteran. He's a veteran.
He's a vet. So And he's smoking weed.
He's smoking weed. Maybe too much. Maybe too much, but he doesn't let too many people know about it. And he's like, you know, he was really jacked up at one point, but drinking a little too much beer now.
So now he's hanging out with hookers.
Yeah.
You know, and he's hanging out with
keeping us from darting out on our tabs
right.
at the strip clubs.
Exactly. Exactly. Whether you're playing Mega Touch or not. For anybody who listened to last week's episode, we had a whole conversation about strippers. It was a brief conversation, but it was a conversation about strippers. And Bobby, of course.
Hookers.
It was hookers. Yeah. Russell's therapy. Now, does your insurance cover that portion of your therapy with the hookers, or that's not?
I think my insurance company actually is going to drop me as soon as they hear that.
Yeah, you've done.
That little rant.
That is. It's all over. All right. So now we have talked about all that stuff. Now I have something that I'd like to discuss, which is for anybody who knows me, and if you listened to the episode last week where we interviewed Nick Liberato, who is the chef from who owns Venezuela in Venice Beach, as well as he's the chef from Bar Rescue. So he's one of our good buddies. He's one of our good buddies. But one of the things that I love so much about Nick is his passion for what he does. And also his passion for the industry and for – I call it the passion for the jacket. Okay, so the jacket is something that I'm a firm believer in. When I was 19 years old and I decided to go to culinary school, I was kind of a lost kid. I really didn't know what I was going to do, man. I remember working in a restaurant and saying that I was never going to work in a restaurant again because I hated the fact that I had to work nights and weekends. I missed my friends. I was a 19, 20-year-old kid. I really wasn't sure what I was going to do. So I remember getting accepted at the restaurant school in Philadelphia, which is where my alma mater, where I graduated from. And I remember the first day, and I remember them giving me the jacket, and it was a defining moment for me because it was something where I realized that this is something that was going to define me for the rest of my life, that I was going to be a chef. When I graduated from school, I was going to have a culinary degree, and I was going to be a chef. So it was something that was really important to me. So now the respect of the jacket is something that's very important to me. So what has happened over the last, I really want to say the last 10 to 12 years, is that the jacket has kind of gone by the wayside, which is fine. I'm okay with that. I still wear my jackets. I'm a big fan of them. I don't wear check pants. I don't wear a toque, the big white hat, or I don't wear a neckerchief, any of that stuff. But I wear jackets. I wear really, really cool jackets from a company called Lost Car. They make my jackets for me. They're a custom jacket maker out of LA. They're beautiful. They're now doing really nice jackets. But it's a jacket, and I'm very proud of my jackets.
Yes.
So
I mean, it's kind of there's a bar in New York called Employees Only, and a lot of bars are doing this nowadays too. But you know, the bartenders / mixologists are having their basically their bar chef jackets, you know, and specifically Employees Only. You know, there's a documentary called Hey Bartender that stars a good friend of mine, Steve Schneider, who we're going to have on the show. Steve, by the way, if you're listening to this, I'm going to – this is me asking you to come on the show. and you see this in the documentary, but this – him graduating from being a bartender to being a principal bartender and the passing of this jacket to him, which is in the documentary, is a big, big deal.
Hold on. What's the name of this? What's the name of this?
Hey Bartender.
Hey Bartender. I want to check this out. Okay. I like to watch Russell. When Russell like references a book or a movie or something of that, like I always write it down because I want to know what the stuff that Russell talks about interests me. I want to know that stuff because I can go back and then go, oh yeah, totally. It's like me when I talk about a movie that with food that is, there's a couple of good ones. One is Euro Dreams of Sushi. You ever seen Euro Dreams of Sushi?
I have not.
Insane,
dude.
It's about Yiro who has a sushi place in the Tokyo train station, and it's the number one sushi restaurant in the entire world. So when you get a chance, watch Yiro Dreams of Sushi. It's a great one. There's another great documentary called Spinning Plates. Check those two out. But I interrupted you yet again. So go ahead. So you were talking about Hey Bartender.
Oh no, that's the that was it. You know, I mean, it was
All right, so let me hop back into this. So one of my biggest pet peeves is the term that is used as an executive chef. Executive chef is somebody who oversees an entire kitchen. They literally are the executive of that kitchen. They oversee the entire brigade.
They oversee your sous chefs and your line cooks and your dishwashers, and they, you know, typically they oversee the front of house as well. In an educational standpoint, they're the ones teaching and doing that. But one of the other major responsibilities of an executive chef is the finances of the business. The kitchen itself is a business. Look, we don't get into the restaurant business to stand back and go, wow, I really hope I make money today. We say, I'm going to make this much money today. Okay.
Yeah.
It is a business. It is a science in certain aspects of it. If I bring in this much food, I need to make this much money off of it. That's what it comes down to. Okay. It's a mathematical equation a lot of times. So I deal with a lot of guys who have executive chef on their resumes, and I don't know where this came from, whether it was something I noticed, like I said, about 10 or 12 years ago, it really started to become prevalent in the industry, where all of a sudden we had these guys who had been working in kitchens for 2 years now becoming executive chefs. So what I've started to see is I interview clients all over the world, or I interview chefs all over the world for clients. It's a part of my business. I do a whole hiring process with them. I offer suggestions. I look at resumes. I do background checks. It's kind of fun for me, actually, because I enjoy talking to chefs. And when I see that I've talked to a chef who's an executive chef, I know that I'm going to have a good conversation. Well, let me rephrase that. I knew that I used to be able to have a good conversation, because what's happened these days is – the term executive chef has been so loosely thrown around that anybody who runs a kitchen now, they're calling themselves an executive chef. Now, I'm not talking about Le Bernardin, okay? Eric Repair is the executive chef. He's the owner. He's the whole nine yards. I'm not talking about these higher-end kitchens, these higher-end gastropubs. I'm talking about your basic kitchens, okay, that these guys are using the term executive chef. Because what it comes down to is an executive chef is not only the guy who oversees the kitchen, the staff, the front of house, the back of house, the whole nine yards. He oversees the finances of this. We are in a business, my friends. I always joke around when I talk to people. I say, this is show business, not show friends. Okay? So when you go into a restaurant and somebody gives you something for free, guess what? You took some money away from the business. Okay? You didn't take it out of the pocket of Bob, the bartender. You didn't take it out of the pocket of Tom, the 60% guy. You took it out of the pocket of the owner of the restaurant. Okay? So in reality, it's stealing. I'm not saying that I don't need stuff for free. I like to pay for what it is that I get. I enjoy if somebody throws me a cocktail. I love that. Don't get me wrong. But what I'm saying is, and a lot of people have comp checks and all that stuff, but I'm getting off the topic. Executive chef.
Yeah.
So what I've started to notice during my interview process with these guys is one of the first questions that I ask is, what kind of volume were you doing at your last place? And I'm not kidding you. It's like they stumble. It's like they never expected that somebody was going to ask them the finances.
Well, your business question.
Yeah, they're shocked. And a lot of them say, well what do you mean volume? And I said, well, you know, the volume of the restaurant. How many – what were you guys doing? What kind of a weekly sales were you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, the owner's
we
never
know...
– go ahead.
Yeah, the owner's never there.
Well, they would say the owner's never there. They also end up with, well, the owner never shared that information with us. That was strictly with, okay, so you're the executive chef of the restaurant, but you have no idea what you sold on a daily basis. Okay?
Yeah.
So then I go through the process. Okay, well, can you do me a favor? Did you do inventory? Yeah, we did inventory. So what kind of inventory were you holding? And what that means to me is, what was your final dollar amount at the end of last month? Were you holding $3,500 in food? Because guess what? If you're holding $3,500 in food, that means to me that you're doing a certain number in sales. Okay? So what I ask these guys is, you know, what kind of a number are you holding in inventory? Well, a lot of these guys don't even know the number that they're holding in inventory. They have absolutely no idea. You know, so how can you effectively run a kitchen? It would be like Russell going into a shift not knowing how much vodka he had. It would be like Russell... Exactly. And how much that bottle of vodka cost. When I was running my kitchens, you could come in and say, chef, do we have any onions? And I would say, yeah, they're on the bottom shelf, left-hand side, right next to the potatoes. That's exactly where they were. Other than, yeah, there should be some in the walk-in, which is what I hear a lot of these days. So the reason why I'm bringing this up is because I have some clients. They're really awesome clients. I work a tremendous amount with them. They're very, very good people. And they have – I'm not going to say the name of the restaurant right now because if the guy who I'm going to talk about in a second is in there, I don't want to embarrass him in any way. But I interviewed this guy on the phone, and he knows what he's talking about. We have a very, very good conversation. We had a conversation about numbers, about finances. We had a conversation about labor cost and food. And we had a really nice – it was a great chef conversation and an executive chef conversation.
One of those relatable, great, just industry conversations.
Yeah, the best. You know, we're talking about the theories and how we feel about wait staff. We're talking about the way that we would like to run a kitchen and that sort of stuff. And so when I hung up the phone, I called the owner and I said, hey, you know, this is a guy that I really think is going to be good.
He's really going to be good. So, and again, this is over the phone. This is not a Skype interview. I had no idea what this gentleman looked like. None of that stuff. So what I said to him was, look, we haven't had a chef in this property for 3.5 months. So the only thing that I'm going to ask from you prior to me getting there is just make sure that the kitchen is clean. That's all I ask. Knowing that you've got 7 line cooks that are running a kitchen by themselves with an owner who's in there about 75% of the time, and he has managers in the whole 9 yards. But knowing this, I said, all I'm asking you to do is make sure the kitchen's just nice and clean when I get there, because I hate walking into a property that's dirty because I have to stop my training process to get them to clean the bar prior to, or clean the restaurant prior to me going to work. So
and it just sounds damn cool to say to him before, you know, like, hey, just make sure the place is clean when I get there.
That's all it is. And again, because he was an accomplished, he had a good background. You know, his resume checked out, all of this stuff. So I walk into the restaurant, and I'm pretty professional. When I walk in, I always have a very nice pressed jacket that is typically in the plastic still from the dry cleaner. I travel with a pair of clogs that I only wear in a kitchen that I wipe off at the end of the night, that I put back into a very specific shoe bag. Call me obsessive compulsive or call me professional, whatever you want. So I walk into the kitchen, and I'm looking around for the chef, and out of the walk-in comes this guy who's wearing Chuck Taylors, a pair of shorts, a black chef jacket with his gut hanging out over the top of the shorts that is I can see underneath the jacket. And all it says on his jacket is what, Russell? What do you think it says on this fucking guy's jacket?
Probably says executive chef.
Not even a name. It doesn't have a name or anything. It just says executive chef. Now, anybody who knows me, you can call me chef. That's my title. That's my term. That's my job. That's what it is. But guess what? People know me because of the way that I run my kitchens. They know me because of my professionalism. I don't have to put chef on my jacket. My jackets actually just say Brian Duffy. And that's for a reason. Because I do my job. I don't have to have it on my jacket to tell you who I am. You can tell because of the way that I run a kitchen.
Yeah, the moment that you walk in, you know, that's how I felt when I walked behind the bar. The moment I walked behind the bar, people knew who was in charge.
Yes, exactly. And it's usually like a minute and a half to 2 minute process before they realize who you are. Not as you as Russell Davis, but you as an authority figure behind that bar.
Yeah, the way that you walk right behind that line or right behind that bar, I mean, just the way that you move, the moment you're back there, to me, you can tell that veteran, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, it's so beautiful because, you know, it's weird because we find this and you kind of touched on this with Chef Nick Liberato. But this solace that you find in the insanity of all that, to me, that's where you see the veterans, those guys that can just be in this fucking insane, just torrential, just stormy seas of business, whether it be behind the line or behind the bar, and just people yelling at you and throwing money and ordering cocktails. And yet you're the fucking coolest, calmest cucumber in the room.
Yeah.
You know?
But you know what's funny is that the respect that I have for you guys, because I can yell. I can yell from behind the line. I can have a conversation. On the other hand, can't do that so much because you're direct with the guest.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I would run my bar a little differently than most. And I always thought the hospitality was always, you know, hospitality is never the same for everyone. To me, it's giving the person that you have to read that person, giving them what they need in those moments. To me, when I had to yell or turn something on, even if it was at a customer, which it would happen if I had to regulate somebody, I mean, you deal with drunken crowds. So sometimes you got to teach these people like kids, unfortunately.
Yes. And so, but
you got to use that strategically. So that the moment you're always cool, you're confident, you're calm. But the moment you jump over that fucking bar and take that guy down and you yell at him, you know, before you're about to do it, that you're going to kick him out and you drag him out, you know, to me that you have to the room beyond just the staff, but the room of customers, they have to know who's in charge. And sometimes you got to turn it on.
Yeah. Oh, no, I totally agree, dude. It's the way it happens.
Chef stuff because of the you know, there's the, it's like the term master mixologist. And I am not a master mixologist. I'll put that out there. A master mixologist is a defined term. You know, you have to take a certain amount of testing through the USBG, United States Bartenders Guild, or the National Bartender Association, the IBA, in order to get your master mixology certification. And I'm just kind of anti-establishment, so I make sure that I study and I know all the master mixology stuff, but I'm anti-establishment. I'm kind of that guy. So
you don't want initials?
Yeah, exactly. I don't care about the initials anymore, you know? But yeah, and just keep on adding them. But, you know, I used to care about that. That's when I was young and dumb. And then, you know, to me, it just turned around. It's like, do cool things and people will respect you for it. But at the same time, you'll never hear me refer to myself as a master mixologist.
Yeah.
But even the term mixologist, you know, I loved hearing you say that the chef is the means head of the brigade, you know, because a bartender was a bar is short for barricade. And barricades existed, you know, between the customer and the liquor. And these barricades existed in public houses, which are short term for pubs. But, you know, originally when you know, throughout the culture of mankind, you know, bars were the churches. They were the community centers. They were the place to drink. These public houses, these pubs, which had these barricades in them, were the places that all business was done. And so a bartender was – bar was short for barricade, and bartender was that guardian of the fun. And so to me, in order to call yourself a bartender, you have to work behind the bar. Now, a mixologist to me is just another certain set of skills of crafting cocktails and knowing a little bit more about the spirits and the actual techniques of what you're doing. But, you know, so I'm a mixologist now because I do that, but I'm not a bartender anymore because I don't tend that bar. I don't have a bar that I tend anymore. I'm not fighting that battle. And I think it's so a fucking respectable profession that I wouldn't diminish it because I'm no longer a bartender and I respect it and I miss it, you know, every day. But I'm more of a mixologist. And at the same time, you can be a mixologist and a bartender at the same time as well. I think that each set of skills carries over. But, you know, you have these kids these days that might pop open a beer bottle at Chili's and call themselves a mixologist, but that's not the case either, you know?
Yeah. No, I agree, dude. I totally agree. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm a chef. That's what I do. I oversee kitchens. I oversee the staff. I oversee the whole part of it. I really make sure that I'm involved in it. I mean, that's the whole thing for me. I want to be involved. I want to be in the kitchen. I miss the kitchen. That's why I'm opening restaurants right now. That's why I'm getting ready. I opened 77 restaurants, dude, in the last 7 years. Jeez. 77 restaurants. I did last year. I did 9 restaurants in 10 weeks, brother. That I opened. I have it down to such a science, but hold on. I want to finish this thought. I want to finish this executive chef thought because this is something that was funny to me. So out walks Slobby McSlobberton out of the walk-in, okay, with his gut hanging over his short and his black dirty jacket that says executive chef on it. And one of the things that I notice is he's kind of looking at me and he walks over and introduces himself and you know, he says, "Chef, it's a pleasure to meet you." I said, "Oh, it's nice to meet you too, whatever your name is, Sloppy McSlobberton." And so I said, "Okay, I'm going to get myself ready and then we're going to hop on the line. And, you know, it's 11:15 right now. So you should have already had a line check done and you should have already had all the stuff done that you have to get done. But right now what I want you to do is I'm just going to get ready." So I reach over and I take my jacket that's hanging on the wall. I take the plastic off. I remove my shirt. I always have a very special tank top that I wear underneath of my chef jackets because I'm comfortable in them. I put my jacket on, and he's kind of staring at me like I'm a little weird. I take my shoes off. I wipe my shoes off. I'm a huge fan of shoes for anybody who doesn't know. I love shoes. Every time I do a really cool show or if I get, you know, a couple extra bucks, I buy myself a nice pair of shoes. It's just the way that I am. So I take my shoes off. I remove my clogs out of the bag. I put my nice shoes in the bag. I put them down. I put my shoes on. I put my apron on. Now I'm professionally dressed for the job. You know, they always say dress the part. Well, I dress the part. Yeah. That's what it is. I'm the boss. I dress the part. So I go into I finally go over to the line. I said, "Chef, I'm going to hop over. Come on over when you're ready." And he sits down at the desk. Now, no offense, but you got a guy who's come in who's as professional as I am when it comes into first coming into a kitchen and being in there. And you're just going to sit down. You're not going to follow me over to the line? What the hell's that about? So I go over to the line. It's now 11:30. We had a 10-minute conversation. Yeah. We had a conversation. We chatted. We talked. We did this. He's telling me about food cost and what he set up. Meanwhile, and I looked at him. I said, "Well, the kitchen looks like it still needs a little bit of work." Okay. Well, I had a crazy week, dude. One of my guys didn't show up here, and I said, I do want to just remind you. The only thing I asked you to do was just make sure that it was a clean kitchen by the time I got here. Okay. So we're not to that point yet. So he sits back down at the desk.
Okay, so now I go over on the line. I start banging out a couple of checks. I'm working with the guys. It's great to see you.
Did you have firing capabilities, like even for his level?
Oh, yeah, totally. But
To me, that was done. I would have been like, exactly. Not even a moment.
And I've only done that once or twice. And the reason why I do that is because, one, I'm not in that property every single day. Okay, I'm not in his property every single day. But where I am is I'm dealing with him on that basis. So I'm not there. I don't have to cover his shifts. The owner's got to cover his shifts. The kitchen staff has to cover the shifts. So I really try to work with people because when people call me and they say, I want to fire this guy, this chef is an asshole, and I don't feel like dealing with him anymore. I got to get rid of him. I say to the owners of these places, and you can ask anybody who I've ever worked with, have we given him all of the tools, them, him, her, whoever it is, have we given them all of the tools that they need to succeed? That's the key. Because guess what? If I didn't give this guy enough pens, then I didn't give him the tools to succeed, okay? But when you come in as a chef, you have a certain amount of stuff that you should know and you should be doing. So I walk over on the line. I start banging it out. Next thing you know, the checks start coming in. It's 11:45. He's still on the computer. 11:50. He's still on the computer. Finally, I just yell over. I'm like, hey there, buddy. Any chance you're going to hop on the line with us and actually cook today? Oh, yeah, I'm just trying to bang this out. So it was at that point that I said, I suggest you take the jacket off. Which isn't really, it's a tough one. It's a tough one. But that's kind of my story, and there's no crazy ending to it. We left it that way. Just so you know, the guy ended up quitting. He didn't want to work there anymore. He said to me, and I'm not kidding you, to the owner, if I'm not mistaken, I'm just going to go back and collect unemployment. He didn't want to do the volume. He didn't want to do the work. You know, this is a guy who had a wife and two kids. His wife wasn't working. He's got two kids. And he just gave up a great paying job in a depressed area of the middle of the country, and we paid him a good dollar amount, but he didn't want to do the work, man. So that's it. So just to kind of wrap this up a little bit, Russell, one of the things that I want to do, I mean, we had a good talk about the executive chef and my feelings on the overuse of it. What I'm trying to say here is that I'm not saying that executive chefs are overused. What I'm saying is that term is. There's too many chefs or too many kitchens out there. There's too many cooks out there that the title is being given to in a loose manner. I think that if you're going to be considered or you're going to call yourself an executive chef, then you really need to dig in a little bit more. One of the things that I want people to do is I want themselves to really get a definition of what that term is. An executive chef is somebody who oversees the entire kitchen, okay? And that doesn't just mean the food. It doesn't just mean the labor. It means every aspect of it, okay? It's one of those things that's really important that I want everybody to do because I'm really, let me say this again. I'm really sick and tired of seeing executive chef on a resume. I get excited about having a conversation with an executive chef that I can discuss food, that I can discuss labor, that I can discuss organization, that I can discuss food cost with, because when you get there, you have no idea what the hell you're talking about. So do me a favor, rethink that term. If you feel the need, do some research on it, get a little bit further into it, contact me if you have to. But guys, let's make sure that the term executive chef is something that's really being used in the right manner. That's all I got to say about that.
Okay, guys, so this is Russell Davis back. So we're going to be honest with you. This is actually round two of the interview with Eric because one of your lovely co-hosts, yours truly, can't seem to get his technical shit together. So this is only the second podcast, and I've gone through three microphones, multiple Wi-Fi areas, and still just can't seem to get it right. But that's what's kind of interesting is that we're all hospitality guys that's on this interview right now. But we've been going into production, having to learn television, having to learn this kind of stuff as we're going along. And, you know, when these things happen, it almost feels like you're in the bar and your credit card or your computer system shut down and you're just trying to figure out what the hell's going on, you know?
Dude, I've worked in bars before. I've seen bars that don't have a crash kit.
Yeah.
So, like, the Wi-Fi goes out and no one knows what to do. Like, oh my I don't God. Know how to charge people.
How am I supposed to take their order? The system's down. What am I going to do?
You're like, you're the manual credit card transactors, right? Huh? What are those? You're like, oh, shit. Are you serious?
And then you got all the guys, like, printing out the pieces of paper and then rubbing the credit cards on the walls and the receipt, you know?
Yeah, have fun calling the credit card company with that, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's weird because like whenever those situations happen, you're like running around with the chicken with your head cut off. I mean, you got revenue that you're losing, you're trying to get it up, and then on top of it all, sometimes you're actually supposed to be bartending at the same time, so it's like hell breaks loose. Yeah. So yeah. But you know, that being said, what's really cool for me, Eric, is that, and I just now realized this in the past few weeks when we've been discussing this, is that you're jumping into the production side of things now too.
Yeah, it was all by accident. I don't think I ever really planned on it. I didn't realize that I owned a production company until after we made the documentary. it was like by coincidence. I think you're the one that notified me of that. Yeah, so basically what we did is I worked on this documentary. We filmed a documentary in October, for September and October, and just kind of traveled around the U.S. and interviewed a lot of bartenders. And I feel like a lot of the stuff you see, you know, online, that tends to focus on you know, the recipe aspect, but I feel like there isn't enough stuff you see out there in the documentary form, at least that just talking like the bartender, like trying to get like the soul of the bartender, what they're actually trying to do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's to actually nail down the lifestyle. You know, that's interesting you would say that, because I feel like a lot of the stuff that has been out there really beautifies the industry, which great, and beautifies the career, but doesn't necessarily show the real truth and the real humans behind what mixology bartending is.
Yeah, the human aspect has been missing a lot. So we just got to just, you know, hang out. We'll just talk to them, man, and be like, hey, so what's it like bartending in Boise? What's it like bartending in Tucson, Arizona? And, you know, I feel like the press, the cocktail press, is so centered around just like the massive metropolitan areas, you know, like New York, San Francisco, L.A., that I feel like the states that get looked over, we don't really know what's going on there. And I'm glad we did this documentary, because what's going on there is fucking cool.
Yeah. I totally agree. I mean, I think I've got clients all over the world, but some of my favorite clients, not that I'd like any more than another, so everybody be careful and don't worry, but I love my Midwest, man. I love my Midwest. And I'm not talking about downtown Chicago. I'm talking about Rockford, Illinois. You know, I'm talking about Breeze, Illinois. I'm talking about these places that are these tiny little spots.
Manhattan, Kansas.
Yeah, Manhattan, Kansas. Dude, they crush it out there.
Yeah, I mean, to me, these markets, and I think you guys will agree with this, I feel like my consulting company actually specializes in these secondary and tertiary markets, and to me, that's where the real numbers are run. Yeah, you go to the big cities to start revolutions and to create a movement, but to really run real numbers and to make your best margins, these secondary and tertiary markets are the perfect places to do it.
Mm-hmm. Plus, I feel like, you know, start as a people who want to start a business or get into craft cocktails, I think it's easier to start in those markets because, you know, in a place like New York, it's so hard to wow a customer because
agree.
15 craft cocktail bars on every, and you know, every two or three blocks.
Yep.
But if you don't, if you open a kick-ass spot, you know, like in Riverside, California or something, fuck, you can blow people's minds, you know?
Yep, absolutely. And the thing is, I think, I always say that the Midwest is a couple years behind us, and we all understand that. I mean, we're seeing the trends that happen on the West and the East Coast that are starting to make their moves in, and they're, you know, they're a little bit further behind with it in some of the stuff. But I have a lot of clients to talk to, and one of the first things they say is like, you know, I don't want to be really aggressive. I don't want to be too aggressive. And I said, well, nobody else is. So why wouldn't you be aggressive? Why wouldn't you do something that is above and beyond what everybody else is doing? Set yourself apart from other people. And when they have that conversation, we start to put the menus together and drink, you know, cocktail menus together and whatnot. Then they start to see when the guests come in, you know, and then they start to talk about it. They absolutely love it. And that's what's cool. Give it to them, man. Give it to them.
Oh, yeah, man. And because of that.
God, get a set of balls.
Because of all the tours and everything we saw, we ended up starting a YouTube series of where we talk to bartenders, just hang out in roundtable format, just talk shit, man. Drink whiskey and let loose, man.
That's awesome. I'm telling
you, it's amazing.
That's great, man.
That's scary. That's scary. Yeah. it's kind of like what we do anyways. You just put a camera up.
We just turn a camera on, you know? So that just rolled out this last week. You could check that out at bartenderatlarge.com. And we're just pretty much rolling that out until the movie comes out, kind of just, you know, build an audience and kind of gather our community together.
Hey, what's that? What's that website again? I'm sorry. What's that again?
Bartenderatlarge.com.
Bartenderatlarge.
Bartenderatlarge, man. What? I love the name too. The name is great. It literally perfectly describes what you're doing too.
Yeah, man, it's a lot of fun. But
what are you most excited about? Sorry.
What am I most excited about? You know, I'm mostly excited about spreading some love and showcasing places that kind of get looked over far too often. For instance, I'm thinking of a place, the Modern Hotel in Boise, Idaho. It's phenomenal, man. Like, I had cocktails as good as there as anything as I've ever had in, like, you know, San Francisco or London or anything else. A gentleman by the name of Michael Bowers runs that bar and just makes incredible drinks. And you'd be so surprised going, you know, Boise, I think, has like 200,000 people. And they're cranking out these incredible world-class cocktails. And I just love that Bartender at Large is giving us a forum to kind of spotlight, you know, places that can't afford, you know, $6,000 worth of PR every month.
Dude, this is a great website.
Oh, thanks, man.
This is a great website. I love the fact that you have the tour dates on here and the places you've gone to or places you're going to.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. I like that. Big, big fan. Nice job, dude.
Oh, right on. Thanks, man.
By the way, I love how Duffy is like on point with like Twitter or like looking anything up when we're talking. Like, you literally can just bring something up and then I'll hear typing and then Duffy's like, oh, awesome website.
I do, because you know what? Because and I'll be honest, Russell, one of the reasons why I enjoy one our friendship so much is our relationship is because of the fact that I learn from you. And if I don't know something, because you guys talk, you guys have a whole different world than I do. Even though we're in the same hospitality world of what we do, your world behind that bar is completely different than what I have. You know, you guys have the guests directly in front of you. You guys are literally like the pulse of what's going on right out there. And behind the kitchen, it's great, and we have fun, and we have all the good stuff that's going on back there. But so when you mention something, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. I'm going to look it up, man. It's that simple. So
have you seen – so I know what I've – and by the way, thanks, Duffy. I mean, like, I think that Eric and I believe the same way as, you know, it's interesting because we feel the same way about the line, the kitchen, and everyone that's in the back of the house is like, you know – I look at some of the things that you guys are doing and I'm just thinking, gosh, that's really tough. How can they do this? How can they sit back there and create and not get the glory all the times and be sitting in that kitchen and running their asses off and getting burned and being hungover or not, you know?
Well, that's me today. Yeah, I'm hurting.
So have you seen the I mean, I know I've seen it, but I think you're seeing it in these smaller markets, is the American palate is finally opening up to these broader range of flavors.
You know, honestly, I think a large part has helped us. One thing that's helped us is craft beer being so popular and coffee.
Yeah.
But because of those two, I feel like they've kind of expanded people's palates, and they're more comfortable with bold flavors. They're more comfortable with bitter. So. Yeah. You know, they're not afraid. They don't want everything to be flavorless anymore. You know, the people are falling back in love with bold flavors. And, you know, and right behind that, you know, you got cocktails like the Negroni, the Manhattan coming in because people's palates have been primed.
Yeah. I mean, you started seeing more of a female population drinking whiskey now. You know, there's more women or whiskey drinkers than ever. And, you know, it was really awesome to, you know, and you are one of the forefront of this revolution to get people to start drinking. Oh, well, thanks. But you specifically in getting people to drink gin.
Yeah, yeah. But I honestly feel, I think it's just people's palates have been like primed already and people aren't afraid of flavor. I feel like for decades, Americans were afraid of flavor and they just wanted everything bland. They wanted chicken tenders with ketchup on them, you know?
Yeah.
And now people are falling back in love with like real food.
We are in the greatest position for restaurants and bars and cocktails and food and everything that I've ever seen. Ever since, and I know it's going to sound weird, but the whole snout to tail world that is now so accepted is out there. And the funny part about that is everything is falling into place. You know, we don't have these super crazy high plates like we did in the 80s and 90s. We didn't have these, you know, really boring, simple, stupid drinks that we were having in the 80s and 90s of stuff that was going on. We are in such an amazing place in flavor and acceptance of people. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, with TV shows, with the internet, with Google, with all the stuff that's going on, because if people don't know something, they don't have a problem hopping on and looking it up and then going into a place and saying, no, you know what? I know what that is now, you know?
Yeah, so I think a big part of that is the convenience factor, not just in being able to look it up, but also to be able to get things like, you know, there's Amazon. Amazon has made a convenience factor towards products. You know, you can sit at home. And by the way, I totally agree with you. We eat and drink better than humanity has ever had the chance to in the history of time.
Absolutely.
We can sit at home and we can order a 5-year-old bottle of Yamazaki Japanese whiskey and sushi with a naked woman to have the sushi laid on top of and literally sit back and have that delivered to our home within a day.
Yep. Yeah. You
know? So to me, that's just crazy.
Oh, it's amazing, man. There's never been a better time to be a cocktail drinker right now, or mm-hmm. even just a foodie in general. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, you know, this is actually kind of very interesting, because now I've got my favorite and my favorite bartender of all time, Eric Castro, and I got one of my best buddy chefs here on the phone. So, okay, Brian, I know you don't drink cocktails, but I would love to hear that if you were going to drink you don't drink a traditional classic cocktail. It's not necessarily your preference. Not that you don't drink them, right. But when you do drink these cocktails, what do you drink?
I love bourbon, dude. I absolutely love bourbon. That's what I drink, and that's what I used to drink. I mean, now I drink vodka. I drink very, very bland and all the other stuff. I don't know if you know, but I was really fat, so I decided to not be fat anymore. And now I drink vodka on a limited basis, but I love bourbon, man, and I love a cocktail that's just put together. So a lot of times I go into places, and I know bartenders hate this shit, but I hate to say it. Sometimes the bartender might know who I am, and they say they want to make me a drink, and I say, I love bourbon. Make me whatever you want. You know, and I go that way with it. So that's what I drink. And if I do go out to eat, don't get me wrong, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to have a cocktail. I am a huge fan of bourbon. And if it looks good, that's the direction I'm going to go. I like a combination of something that's kind of herbaceous. So it's got, you know, whether there's rosemary or thyme or a marjoram or something that's thrown into it. I like that kind of play with food into the drinks. I like something that is, I like a concoction. That's what I like. So, yeah.
So,
oh, it's nothing wrong with bourbon, brother.
Oh, yeah, not at all, man.
Yeah, I love it.
So what are you seeing on this, you know, as you were traveling and doing this documentary and as you're doing this web series, what are you seeing bartenders drinking out there these days, you know, when they're off shift, and also chefs as well? What's popular these days for this service industry crowd?
What I did notice is I didn't realize how much like climate played a factor on what people are eating and drinking, because, you know, I growing up in California, it's just like the same season all year. We kind of just, you know, like, it doesn't really change much how we eat and drink. But like from visiting even other places, like, I mean, Tucson, for example, is a perfect example. Tucson and Phoenix. I mean, shit, it's 104 in October. So that can't help but just dictate the way people drink. You know, it's like, you know, these bartenders were telling me like, hey man, we love to drink, you know, bitter and stirred drinks, you know, things like old fashioned and Negronis. But if we put a whole bunch of those on our menu, they're not going to sell, because people come in and they're sweating like a pig. And all they want is like a Queen's Park Swizzle. They want a margarita. They want a Tom Collins variation. And it makes perfect sense. You know, I don't know about you, man, but it's like when you're outside and sweating and it's warm, like the last thing I'm going to order is like, you know, a Negroni served up. You know,
The Negroni itself has made like a fucking renaissance for the cocktails.
Yeah, totally. Like if I have that, I'm having it on ice, man, and it's that warm, and just pound it down really fast before the ice melts.
I love that you put it out there, because I'm the same way, man. I will pound it down to get it there before the ice melts, or just to pound it down.
Because I mean, if you're thinking about 104 degrees, you know.
And oh yeah.
And yeah, so I did notice that how much weather dictates people, the way people drink. Denver, I noticed bitter drinks tended to go really well with Denver. I think it's just because of, like, you know, the IPA domination of there, because of, you know, they have such a good microbrewery scene. But yeah, I noticed that just whatever's like the climate and the culture are always going to dictate what people are going to drink.
Yeah, gotcha. Well, guys, you know, Eric, what else is interesting out there? Is there anything that you've just seen that you just want to talk about or get out there?
Oh, hey, did you hear about – no, this is just a news article I read just before I got on here. Did you hear about all that Pappy they have to destroy?
No. What happened?
So a whole bunch of, like, I think 30 bottles of Pappy Van Winkle were stolen. I think it's like the 18-year or something.
Oh, and that's the only bourbon that Ryan Duffy drinks.
Yeah, the police confiscated it and are like, well, we don't know what to do with it. And you know – Pappy Van Winkle reps are like, well, we can't sell it because we don't know if anybody altered it or tainted it or whatever, so we want it destroyed.
No way.
And then, what? You know, the police station's like, well, we could auction it and do it for charity or whatever, but then you know, the Van Winkle reps are even like, hey, well, we don't want you guys auctioning because we don't know what's in it. Somebody could have opened them up, tainted them. Who knows what could have happened to them? So we don't want our name on it.
Yeah.
And now everybody's all distraught and upset that they're going to have to destroy, you know, like, I don't know, how many thousands of dollars worth of whiskey.
Melton, man. Melton is the sheriff. Oh, what the hell is that? That sucks. Sorry, guys. I was reading it up and a pop-up came up. Well, the one of the descendants of the Pappy Van Winkle fortune said that they would not allow it to be sold because they didn't know if it was tainted or not. So that's that was the – damn, that pissed me off.
how much – and this is – and I'm not making any kind of accusations, but just curious and opening up for this discussion, how much do you think some of these decisions that are made or sometimes decided to, you know, that what factors in is to make the rest of the bottles more valuable?
I don't know, but it, you know, it's good press.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, everyone's talking about it this morning. It's all over Twitter. And I think it's just like they can say that that's how firmly they stand behind their quality, that they won't allow anything to be sold unless they know it's 100%.
Dude, it's $250 for the 23-year-old.
So how many bottles was it destroyed again, Duffy?
Hold on one sec. See, now I'm like the
now you're the
I can't guarantee. I'm going to tell you this, that I can't guarantee that that it's something's not going to pop up while I do this. So,
I thought you had already had it open. No worries.
No, I do. It's right here. It was on CNBC. I'm going to try to talk really fast so that 28 bottles of the prestigious brand to be sold at auction, with proceeds mostly going to charitable causes. Melton, who is the sheriff, said Wednesday that Julian Van Winkle III, the grandson of Julian Pappy Van Winkle Sr., raised concerns about putting the whiskey up for sale. Van Winkle wants the motherfucker. who is talking? Anyway, the sheriff.
And we don't sponsorships anymore.
Exactly. The sheriff said that he would follow through with their wishes and that he would absolutely destroy that, which means that he's probably sitting in his house right now, just a complete shit show with 28 bottles of Pappy hanging out around him. So, Melton, you go, boy.
Yeah. Good job, Melton.
I'll get rid of this myself. Thanks.
Well, you know, it is an awesome whiskey, you know, kind of, so everybody go out there and get yourself a bottle before you can't, because this is only going to press it some more, and it is a great, great whiskey. I mean, it was for a long time known as the best bourbon, right, Eric?
Yeah, that 12 and the 15 are absolutely fucking phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's actually really, really, really fucking nuts.
Yeah.
Especially because they already had, like, something happen in years previous with a bunch of the whiskey getting stolen, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't remember all the details on it enough, so you have to look it up, but you guys go check out Pappy Van Winkle. It's an amazing whiskey, but it has some really, they really do stand behind the quality and what they're doing, and I also think that they're really good at creating the brand awareness very well, too, so mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, Duffy, you got any more questions for Mr. Castro?
No, dude, Eric, I can't wait to hang out with you, man.
Right on, brother. Look forward to drinking some whiskey with you, man.
Yeah, as soon as you get, once you get up into, when you get back into New York, just hit me up. You know, we'll get all of our stuff together so you have it. But I'm up in New York quite a bit, so I'd love to come out and hang out with you, man. Have a couple cocktails and have some fun.
It's happening, brother. It's happening.
Good.
So just to give a little bit of rundown, if you guys want to find Eric, his consulting company is Possessed by Spirits, but right now the coolest thing that he is releasing is Bartender at Large, the web series, and also the future documentary. Eric, where can we find you online, my friend?
Hungry Bartender. At Hungry Bartender on both Twitter and Instagram.
Awesome. And don't forget that you spell Eric, everyone out there, you spell Eric with an E-R-I-C-K. Eric runs into this problem a lot.
It happens, yeah. Thanks for having me, and congrats on the second episode.
Well, Eric, thanks, man. And on a personal note, I'll never forget that moment of when you came into Peche in Austin, Texas, and guest bartended that night, you know, from Bourbon and Branch, and having a blast and just meeting a brother and within one night. And
partying until 8:30 in the morning?
Partying until 8:30 in the morning. Drinking a $6 bottle of scotch. You know, I can't thank you enough for that phone call that you gave me
that brought me from Austin, Texas to San Francisco so I could hone my craft. And I owe my bartender of the year win, and I owe the ability to have been on staff at Rick House when we won top high volume cocktail bar at Tales of the Cocktail to you. I owe career to you, man. And I fucking love you, Eric.
Hey, brother, I did was open the door, man. You chose to walk through. It's all you.
I love that, man. I know that we'll be doing some more stuff. Eric and I have got a couple of things that we're talking about producing together. And so this will not be the last you hear of Eric Castro on the Road Rash podcast or with Russell Davis. So thank you, guys. Thanks so much, my friend. Thank you, guys.
Much love.
Cheers, brother.